Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our special guest is Robert England. Robert is a journalist and author who has written extensively on mortgage finance, banking, retirement policy, and the financial and economic impact of aging population. His most recent work is Black Box Casino, How Wall Street's Risky Shadow Banking Crashed Global Finance. His previous works include Aging China, The Demographic Challenge to China's Economic Prospects. Robert is also a senior writer for Mortgage Banker magazine. Robert, welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I really appreciated Black Box Casino. I'm kind of familiar with the overall story, and I've read a few other books. But there was one thing that your book really did that was very helpful, and there's a lot of insider terms that when you're in Wall Street and you watch Squawk Box, they use those terms as if the world knows what they mean. And every time you had one of those to use, you then took time to say, this is what that means. And it really was very, very helpful.
Well, thank you very much. I did that after a copy editor was reviewing my work, who had a general background and didn't have a financial background. And she kept saying, but I don't understand what this means. And so if she didn't understand what it means, I decided I needed to define that term.
And it really was helpful because there's some things you just hear and you sort of pretend you know. But then you really, if you had to explain to somebody, you go, okay, well, I really don't know what that is. And so it made clear some of the shenanigans, actually, that were able to go on. And it just allowed me to understand the book better. The book talks about events as they unfolded in 2007 and 8, yet you just wrote the book in 2011. And I have a feeling there were good reasons you waited.
Well, it took a while to get a publisher interested and to get a book contract. That's part of the reason. And another thing was that information came out later on that was more helpful than what was available immediately after the crisis. And that includes a lot of research that was dug up by the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. So I'm glad that I waited a little bit.
Yeah, I thought that you had more information than probably was readily available. But I also wonder if, as time passed, maybe people were more apt to say what really went on because there was a safety of distance between the events.
I think that was true for some sources in the book. But for other sources, they clammed up because whatever they had been involved with was being embroiled in lawsuits, and so they didn't really want to talk.
Okay. The name Black Box Casino, what does that title describe?
Well, it is a concept that describes the change that was occurring in the global financial system. First of all, there was the increasing prevalence of black boxes within the system, which are financial instruments and institutions that have no transparency. You can't see what's going on inside, so they are a black box. And the casino part comes from learning that much of the activity that went on in a number of these black boxes was, in fact, speculation and even wild speculation.
When we used to think of Fannie and Freddie, we used to think of the safest possible loan pool with a mandate to keep safety as first priority. How wrong is that perception?
That is completely 180 degrees from the reality that was going on at Fannie and Freddie. And, in fact, the way that the regulation was set up to govern in Fannie and Freddie, it did not guarantee that they would be operated in a safe and sound manner. It may, in fact, have encouraged them to do the opposite.
GSEs, that stands for government-sponsored enterprises?
Yes.
Okay. Did that title come with benefits?
It does come with benefits because the government is sponsoring what you do. You're a private corporation that has shares that are publicly traded and that benefit the executives of the company if they can use the public mission of the corporation to increase revenues and profits for them themselves. So it's a hybrid form of a business that comes with a lot of problems and can, you know, reap a lot of damage if things get out of hand.
Political clout. Did they have considerable political clout?
Yes, both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were had a considerable amount of clout in the beginning before the regulations were set up to govern them. But once the regulations were put in place, there were a number of provisions in the regulations and the statute that gave them a lot of power. For one thing, they were allowed to lobby, and they also got involved with making campaign contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they were a government-sponsored enterprise, logically they shouldn't have been allowed to lobby the government. But what happened is that by giving them this authority to lobby, or more specifically not prohibiting it, it allowed them to make contributions and influence Congress and give politicians a way to provide benefits to constituents without having to go through the budgeting process, since everything that was going on at Fannie and Freddie was, you know, not involving the budget. Their own, even their regulator was given minimal powers to regulate them and keep them in line, and this in turn gave them more clout. The regulator did not have a source of income from fees, which is usually what the banking regulators have, but had to go to Congress every year and get funding for their activities. So they were hamstrung by the way the law was set up.
The law that we're talking about, is that the 1992 Federal Housing Enterprise Financial Safety and Soundness Act?
That's it. That was a very important law that really...
It sounds good.
Well, if only it had lived up to its billing. It was supposed to have been set up for safety and soundness, but once Congress got a hold of the original idea and started devising a bill, and they got through with it, it was really put together in a way that would benefit politicians the most, as I've described, because it would give them a way to constantly provide a benefit to a constituency, and that benefit would constantly rise over time. There was no way to restrain that the lowering of lending standards, which would be required to increase the level of lending to designated populations.
Well, so and that's the part that, you know, you mentioned they contained federal affordable housing provisions, which was a kind of a coup for the politicians. So let's talk about what those were, because I was shocked to understand that they really had a mandate. They had to loan to low to moderate income people a certain percentage of their loans.
Well, when the GSE Act was being put together, at that point, both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had informal goals in place that they would lend approximately 30% of, you know, their business would be acquiring loans that were to borrowers who were low or moderate income borrowers. And that reflected pretty much a natural market share for an entity in their position that would not distort the market. But the crafters of the legislation wanted to give HUD, and as it turned out in this case, the right to raise the affordable housing goals that were put into the law and to do them on a periodic basis and to be able to constantly raise them without any consideration to whether or not it would impair the safety and soundness of Fannie and Freddie.
What's interesting about this is this legislation really came on just after the S&L crisis. So you'd kind of think that everyone would be in the mood to create something that was safe and sound.
Well, I think probably everyone was in the mood, but no one was paying attention to what was being done. First of all, the concept that you would now securitize loans, that would be the predominant way to finance mortgages, was thought to be the way they would reduce the potential fallout from, say, a bad period of lending that occurred with the savings and loans, which held their mortgages on their books. And when interest rates rose very high, there was a huge mismatch between their assets and liabilities, which, you know, did them in. But securitization was supposed to take that risk off the books. So starting with that, people thought they had, you know, a magic solution, but they didn't look, they didn't put together a regulatory regime that would be capable of assuring the safety and soundness of Fannie and Freddie, from setting up capital standards to allowing them to invest in having an investment in portfolio, and to not allowing the safety and soundness regulator to raise their capital standards if it, they deemed that they were inadequate at any point. And the regulator, aside, in addition to having to go to Congress every year for money, was also not an independent regulator. They were a part of HUD. And they did not have any control over the safety, over the affordable lending goals, and could do nothing about them. And HUD did not have to consider safety and soundness when they were setting those goals. Those goals, which were 30%, as I said, at that time, the number one goal, there were actually three goals. The main goal was raised to over 55% by the time of the crisis.
So,
and there was a subsequent goal to low-income, an additional goal to low-income households, which is more narrowly targeted. That had not existed before, and it began at about 11% and rose to nearly 27% at the time of the crisis.
Now, that was part of the 50-some percent?
Yes.
Okay. But over half of Fannie and Freddie's loans, maybe I don't understand how people qualified. Were they really subprime, or were they good credit but low income?
Well, over time, the lending standards at Fannie and Freddie declined in order to meet these affordable lending goals.
Okay.
And as the goals were put in place gradually, they weakened their lending standards. They first lowered the down payment, and then they gradually lowered the FICO score for borrowers to qualify, you know, to be part of the Fannie and Freddie program. And then they increased the segment of the business that was funding subprime without identifying that publicly.
Okay.
And then they drastically increased the amount of business funding alternative A, or low and no documentation loans, even more so, and again without publicly acknowledging this. And the legislation that set up Fannie and Freddie did not require them to file quarterly audited statements to the Securities and Exchange Commission. So they could get away with, without telling investors the truth about their portfolios. And as, you know, around by the time of 2000, they were doing 100% loan-to-value mortgages and were greatly expanding their subprime lending, but it was never identified as that. And that's how we ended up this past week with the SEC filing charges against former Fannie and Freddie executives for lying about the amount of subprime and Alt-A in their portfolios and in their investment holdings.
They had a black box.
Wildly at odds with the actual amount that was in there.
Now, did a lot of the fulfillment of those lower income goals happen because they were able to invest in mortgage-backed securities that had those loans in them?
That was both through acquiring them and not calling them subprime, and also through buying private label mortgage-backed securities that had loans that met the qualifications, that would meet those goals.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the former head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, Jim Lockhart, has said to me in an interview recently that they could not have met their goals if they hadn't bought up a lot of the private label mortgage-backed securities, and they bought huge amounts of it. They were the major purchaser of private MBS.
Another reason might have been that they were able to leverage that just a little bit. Is that right?
Yes. They had their capital standards were very low, so they could leverage these acquisitions and increase their earnings and by extension, the compensation of the top executives, you know, as most of the listeners may know, the former heads of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were involved in accounting scandals in 2003, 2004, where they were found to have manipulated the earnings targets to maximize their compensation. And both Franklin Raines and Leland Brinzel had to leave the two GSEs at that time. And that pattern of, you know, you can for one thing, you can gen up the amount of securities you purchase to increase your overall compensation and the profitability. At first, profitability that was at first profitable, but later wasn't, of the firm. And then by creating a compensation system that rewarded the executives by tied to increasing volumes, it really, you know, it drove the GSE's top executives to great, you know, constantly expand their business in order to make more money for themselves.
The leverage for a mortgage-backed security, you state in the book, was 222-1.
That was for the guarantee. There were two capital rules. One was for the guarantee was 222-1, and Fannie and Freddie had to only hold 0.45% capital against the guarantees of paying the principal and interest to the investors in their securities. And if they held any of the securities that they purchased, they could hold their own securities once they were securitized, or those of the private label securitizers. They only had to hold 2.5% capital against that. And by early 2008, the GSEs were leveraged about 100-1 overall when you blend those two on standard accounting, under standard accounting rules. And that's another, the accounting rules were another way that Fannie and Freddie were able to get away with what they did. They didn't have to meet what are normally considered bank accounting rules, but could use generally accepted accounting principles, which allowed them to use some types of securities and assets to count as their capital when other people didn't. And that included, for example, losses that could be claimed against future taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when you're losing money constantly, there's no gains to apply those losses against.
What were the intended consequences of lowering lending standards? What was the agenda?
Well, the whole idea was to increase home ownership rates among lower-income and moderate-income households. The home ownership rate, I think, was around 64 or 65% at the time that the GSE Act was passed. And, you know, they were hoping to raise it dramatically so that particularly minorities would have home ownership rates similar to those of whites. And there was a disparity between both African-American and whites and Hispanics and whites in terms of the percentage of the population that owned a home. And although the home ownership rates were like 45% or close to 45 to 50% range, they weren't they were better than a lot of people might have thought, but they weren't in the mid to high 60s.
There was legislation in the 70s that tried to correct those things. So Home Mortgage Disclosure Act 1975, that required the banks to collect data on who the person was that was the borrower as far as race, that type of thing. And the Community Reinvestment Act in 1977 against redlining. I'm a lender, so, you know, it's when you're a lender, there's areas that, you know, you're not trying to be prejudiced, but you realize that an appraiser could literally get shot. I mean, I actually, you know, I'm in the hard money loan business, and we get asked to go to certain areas to do loans, and all those things come into play that you're actually in danger. And so redlining, the intent was not to have a prejudice outcome, which I think is just and fair. But does it also take away the ability to say no sometimes just because you know this isn't going to have a good outcome?
Well, it does. In fact, the effect of all of various laws and provisions and actions of my regulators led banks and lenders to increasingly divorce the decision on whether or not to get a mortgage from the hard realities of what lending is all about. And so at some point, banks, in order to meet their Community Reinvestment Act targets, would just make loans they knew were going to be bad.
Because they had to do that to stay in business?
Yes, they had to do that. The CRA Act originally required banks to make efforts to reach targeted populations, but did not require that specific results be achieved. And the Clinton administration reinterpreted that law and rewrote that regulation regarding that in the mid-1990s and said that they actually had to show results. And then the Federal Reserve began to reject applications for mergers and opening branches and so on to banks that did not have a high score from the data that was collected on lending by race and gender, in fact, also in income, the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data. And so these steps taken by regulators had the effect of forcing banks to make bad loans. And a common criticism of, you know, of people against people who make the claim that the CRA Act had an impact on lending is that, well, it was passed in 1997 and the crisis was in the 2000s. Well, the whole process was very gradual, and the idea of forcing banks to do lending against solid lending principles came into play in the mid-1990s. And as each merger was made or came about in the years after 1995, the banks had to make a commitment to do X amount of CRA lending.
Mm-hmm.
And during the by 2007 or 8, they had made commitments of over $4 trillion, I think close to $5 trillion. So whereas you could go back to the mid-1990s and the CRA lending might be, you know, $50 billion in consequential. In the end, it was trillions of dollars that commitments had to be made.
There's a quote that I read, and I thought this is exactly what happened. The GSE Act became the vehicle for putting forth the philosophical view that housing is a civil right, meaning people are entitled to own a house.
Yes, right. That was the idea. You know, the act was actually written by a group of major provisions of it were written by a group of housing advocates and activists under an informal deputization by Henry Gonzalez, who was the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee in the early 1990s. And these housing activists got together, many of, you know, their attorneys got together and crafted the language in this law to achieve those goals, to make housing more of a right and to impose that idea on lending.
With 1 minute left, are these the same groups now that are coming and saying, well, look at those loan programs, they were unfairly skewed to people of color and of less income?
Yes, they are now rewriting history and saying that lenders deliberately went out of the way to make bad loans. And therefore, you know, they are to blame, not the rules and the regulations and the laws.
And because they were able seemingly to hide in the black box, I don't think very many people, including myself, really understood the mandate underneath the covers that this is what Fannie and Freddie had to do. And
well, the law never, there was not much exposure to what was being proposed and put into the law in the early 1990s. A lot
Robert,
of the people in Congress just thought it was guaranteeing everyone equal access to credit.
Right, not steering it. Robert, we have to end this segment. Robert England, Black Box Casino, thank you very much for joining us.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.